It's apparently working. Okay. So today we are going to continue where we stopped last week on bit parallelism and first exact search, and then we'll say something about approximate search. And of course, with applications in intrusion detection, that will be all relatively short. Then we'll make a short break, and then we go to the next topic, which is our more practically oriented topic, that's the SNORT system. So last time, if you remember, we stopped at shift-end and shift-or, the bit parallel algorithms that actually do not have difference between the worst case and the average time complexity, which is a nice feature. However, they are slower than some other algorithms that have been tried in intrusion detection, and in particular, we mentioned Suricata. Now, what was used in Suricata was this one, backward non-deterministic DAUG matching. Of course, we said that DAUG is abbreviation for directed acyclic word graph, and then we stopped. Now, what is a directed acyclic word graph? Well, we can assign a graph to any string. We are going to see an example on the next slide. I'm going to tell you that we are not going into details of this. It's a big theory. Actually, that was the most advanced theory on search before this bit parallelism. So everything was related to this DAUG, and then they developed some search algorithms that were very fast at the time, like forward DAUG matching, backward DAUG matching, and this is backward non-deterministic DAUG matching. That's an algorithm that combines bit parallelism with the algorithms that existed before that. So it can be shown that a DAUG is equivalent to the DFA corresponding to the NFA assigned to the same string, and we often call that DAUG suffix automaton. Now, how does it look like? Here on the slide 89, you have an example. You have a graph that is assigned to our example string AABCC. You see the search pattern. So we assign a DAUG to the search pattern. Now, ignore these dashed lines. So they are not lines of the DAUG. So these dashed lines are called suffix links. If we ever talk about how a DAUG is obtained from a string, which is beyond the scope of this course, then these suffix links will be mentioned. So for now, just forget about them. So you see you have some bold lines and you have some not so thick lines, you see? So there is also difference. That's also from the construction algorithm. Now, for this case, just to explain what a DAUG is, you can ignore that some lines are thick and some are not. So you just consider DAUG as, you see, it is directed. So all the lines, you see, they go to the same direction, from the special node that is called source to the special node that is called sink, and they all go in the same direction. That's directed acyclic because they go in the same, there are no closed loops. You see, as I said, ignore the dashed lines. So they are not elements of a DAUG. They are so-called suffix links that are used in the construction of a DAUG. Okay, so you see, you have a path that corresponds to any suffix. That's why it is called the suffix automaton. So the main path, you see, AABCC. And then the next suffix, ABCC. You see, there must be a path. You see, ABCC. Then you have BCC, so you go directly to B from the root, you see this one, B, C, C. And then you have C, C, like this, C, C. And finally you have a C. So this is usually not drawn. In the literature you will find that this line is missing. So there should be a line between the source and the sink. And that will be labeled with the last symbol in this pattern. Now, This is just informative. You have seen what a dog is. Now, the algorithm that is based on this BNDM, backward non-deterministic dog matching, combines a dog with beat parallelism. And a small modification of it is BNDMQ, that is a bit faster. And this is an algorithm from 2009. It's pretty new. Now, the advantage of this one is that it processes more input characters at a time, because every computer word is now more than, for example, a byte that is usually used for encoding characters, or 2 bytes, which is Unicode. So if you have an 8-byte computer word, like most of the computers today, you can then process 4 input characters at a time, which makes the BNDM algorithm, whatever it is, we didn't explain how it works, 4 times faster. And this one was actually tried in Suricata. It was used. Now, last time I told you why they were abandoned. They are so-called skip algorithms. Why are they faster than the shift-end and shift-all? Because there is a possibility to skip some portion of characters of the search string where the search patterns cannot be found by any means, cannot be there. That's what makes them faster on average than shift-end or shift-or. Therefore, for these algorithms, BNDM and BNDMQ, the average case time complexity is better than the worst case time complexity, and consequently, they are sensitive to so-called algorithmic attacks. We talked about that before, which makes them not so good for application in RDS. And because of that, they were tried in Suricata as fast and then later abandoned as sensitive to algorithmic attacks. Now, sensitivity to algorithmic attacks is a pretty theoretical thing. So in most cases, you will not be able to exploit this. However, you will find in Blackboard, for example, in our doc section of the topic 2, you will find a paper where it was explained how to exploit this in practice. So it is possible to drive the search algorithm that has better average time complexity and then the worst case complexity to behave poorly, which means slowly. So that was about exact search. Nowadays, all these systems use exact search. So what's the problem? Well, advantages, of course, they are fast, they are reliable, but zero-day attacks cannot be detected by means of them. It is enough to change a single bit, and we are going to give you an example. Now, we haven't studied SNORT yet. We are starting today. However, I have already shown you an example of a SNORT rule. That's a signature of an attack. So this one is an attack, and you have a signature for it. Alert, what to do, TCP, what's the protocol, external net, any port, so from where the traffic comes from, to home net, our protected network, the port 139. If the rule is triggered, then the operator gets this message, NetBIOS SMB CD dot dot. Now, to trigger the rule, in addition to traffic coming from external net any port to home net port 139, these conditions have to be met as well. The flow of the traffic is to server, the connection, TCP connection has to be established previously, and then in the packets there must be found this content, 5c.0000000. Ignore the vertical lines. Vertical lines are information, give information to the system that what is between the vertical lines is hexadecimal. Okay? So the string that is actually searched for is 5C. That's a kind of code for some Unicode character. Then you have /, that's 3 Unicode characters, you see? And then 0000000, that's hexadecimal. Now, of course, we can convert everything to hexadecimal or everything to Unicode, and that's done internally. And then we make the search pattern for which we search in the search string, which means in the whole traffic. Now, this can be changed by an attacker. Without any consequences, we can change a single bit. So instead of 00, we put just 20 hexadecimal. So that's in binary. So in binary, it was 00000000, and now it is 00100000. And the rest is the same. So a single bit of change, and this makes this rule fail. So it's the same attack, it will not change anything, but it will not be detected with this rule. To this end, we would have to change the rule, well, to make a copy of this rule and change every single bit in this content string. That, by changing, doesn't make the attack useless. We are going to discuss that in the end of this lecture, how this can happen. So how can we solve this problem? From the defensive side, we can make a new signature for every variant of an old attack. This is something that is done. So this is currently done in practice, which means you may have 10, 20 rules for the same attack. It's just a single bit or 2 bits of change. This will not change the effect of the traffic, so it is still an attack. However, it will make detection of the attack impossible if you just have one rule. So that's how it is done in practice today. Well, this is efficient because it will detect these small variations. However, you cannot be sure that you will encompass all the possibilities. And besides, there are, well, let's say, I would not say exponentially many, because you cannot change just every bit of this or every combination of bits. We shall go back to this discussion, because if you change too much, then this traffic will not work. It will not be an attack. So the changes that the attackers perform are actually small. Well, anyway, instead of this action, what you can do is use so-called approximate search. So you introduce some tolerance in search, which means you will not match only exactly when you find exactly what you look for, but with some tolerance, let's say 1 character, 2 characters at the most, so no more than that, because it's very difficult to make a big difference in traffic and still maintain the traffic function as an attack, if you are an attacker. Well, if you introduce tolerance, what you get is not only the possibility of detecting variations of old attacks, but also you get false positives, unfortunately. And false negatives also are also possible. Because you cannot take into account the fact that only small or limited changes with specific distribution on the old attack patterns are possible. Because you just say, we accept any change. This will not work. First of all, if you have big changes, traffic could become harmless. No attack. For example, you can change not only this bit, but you can say, if you change this, then it will not work. So you change a single character or a single bit. So this means CD, change directory, this 5C. Change directory to one directory up and then go back one and one down, but to another directory. So you take the control of the victim machine through this netbus. Now, if you change this, then you will not go up in the directory, so the traffic will just do nothing. Okay? So you have to know not only how many bits to change if you are an attacker, but also which bits or which portions of the attack string you must not change. Now, if you are on the defensive side, you will have to guess that, because you don't know this in advance. So you will have to guess where these changes take place. This is not possible. This is very, very difficult. Well, now, how do we solve that? We can constrain our approximate search. For example, you will see what cases are possible. So, for example, we can say we don't allow more than two consecutive bits to be deleted or inserted or something like that. Or we don't allow more than this number of changes. So it's not the number of changes only, it's also the distribution of changes that matters. Well, this is also possible, as we said. The problem with this are false positives, but nevertheless, we consider this as a possibility. So we are going to explain this approximate matching. So up to now, we have studied exact matching. Okay. Now we consider approximate matching, which is string matching allowing up to k errors. What are the errors? Substitutions. For example, character A is substituted by a character B. Or you can insert a character at some position, or you can delete some character. So these are the errors that are possible. So the permutations of characters we do not consider. They can be substituted by insertions and deletions. To this end, what we introduce, well, not we, but the researchers have introduced what is called edit distance already in 1965. So what's that? Considering that these operations, so-called elementary edit operations, are possible, substitutions, insertions, and deletions, then edit distance is the minimum number of these elementary edit operations that are needed to transform one string into another. Sounds logical. The problem arises how to compute this distance, because just trial and error, that's too many trials and errors, so you cannot do it efficiently. Fortunately, of course, we can do it more efficiently, as I'm going to show you. Now, approximate matching is reduced to finding all occurrences of the distorted search pattern, we say W prime, in the search string S, such that the edit distance between the real pattern and this distorted pattern is smaller or equal to some limit. So we can tolerate one error, two errors, etc., etc. Small number of errors. In theory, any number of errors, but in practice, it would be like one, two errors at most. The distortion of W prime is carried out by deleting, inserting, or substituting characters. Now, substitution of character by itself, we call it a match, does not usually contribute to the increase of edit distance, except in computational biology, which we do not consider, of course. So there, this also matters. So it is enough to assign elementary distances equal to 1 to an ordinary substitution and 0 to a character match. So, for example, in computational biology, of course, this is not the topic here, but it's not the same whether you substitute, I don't know, adenine with something or thymine with something. You know this, adeno basis. It matters, which one. Now, in our application, it doesn't matter. Whatever letter you substitute, it costs the same. Of course, all this is just story. Now we give examples to explain. So, edit distance first, and then search with tolerance. So, to understand search with tolerance, you have to find out how to compute edit distance. Because we define tolerance search as search for pattern that whose difference from the real one is smaller than or equal to k regarding the edit distance. For example, you want to find survey in surgery. But now we only want to compute the distance between survey and surgery. Now we say any distance between these two strings is 2. How do I know that? Well, since these strings are very short, it's very easy to find the best match. Now, if they were longer, that would be extremely difficult. Of course, as we said, a match doesn't cost anything. So wherever you can find a match, you put it there. Okay, so you have S with S, U with U, R with R, E with E, Y with Y, but then the rest you have to do something with that. So you can substitute G by V, and you can delete, you see, this is a deletion. This phi is called an empty symbol. Empty symbol is used for presenting deletions if empty symbol is in the lower row, or insertions if it is in an upper row. Now, you count the changes. These do not cost anything, so these are matches. You see, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 matches, so it's still 0 distance. One substitution, any symbol by any symbol, since this is not computational biology, this costs 1. And deletion costs 1. So with one substitution and one deletion, you can transform X to Y. So you can get survey from surgery. By substituting G with V, you get survey, and then you delete R. So you get survey. Yeah? Now, is this a minimum? Well, it's easy to see, since these strings are short, that it is the minimum. So edit distance is the minimum number of these edit operations. Otherwise, you can transform surgery to survey in many other ways. That will cost at least 2. So it cannot cost less than 2, you will see easily. Now, if it were like 30 characters, then it would be... There is a very complicated formula about the number of these of possible transforms of this one to that one. So it is found in the literature. It's a formula with a lot of factorials, gamma functions, etc., in two rows. So it's really complicated. But it's known. So this number is huge as the length of these strings grow. So since this number is huge, guessing the best transforms is out of question. We cannot do it efficiently in this way. But we can do it in another way, as we are going to see. Now, this was the distance. So what about search? So suppose we search for serve in this string. So this XXXXX, this means any character. So whatever can be here. And then we have surgery. And we introduce the tolerance in search, that is 2. So we accept up to 2 errors. So if we find not just serve, but we find, for example, surge, that would be accepted. That would be 1 error. And this is exactly what we can find here, you see. We ignore whatever is before the first match. So we have already seen that. If it were an automaton with a loop in the state 0, as we have seen last time, so we just ignore whatever comes before the first match. And then we find a match, and then you see this is very fine. This costs nothing. Then we have 1 substitution, and then we have found that instead of serve, we have found surge, which is accepted since the edit distance between serve and surge is 1, which is smaller than 2. Okay? And then the rest is ignored. We could also accept this one, surge with serve and a deletion, because the tolerance is 2, so we allow up to 2 errors. So there, it's not a unique solution, you see. So this is possible to do. So the elementary edit operations, as we said, to the left of the first vertical line and to the right of the second vertical line do not count in this distance, because we are looking for the pattern anywhere in the search string. So we have found it here. So that's essentially what we can do in IDS as well. So instead of looking for this string, 5c dot dot slash 0000000, we can tolerate one symbol or one bit or two bits or whatever. So this is possible to do. The question is how to do it in practice, since, as we said, guessing the best transform is not a good idea, not efficient. How can we do that? We can do it at least in two ways. The old one is by using what is called dynamic programming. And the new one is the simulation of an NFA, which is also bit parallel. So we can do bit parallel approximate search. So last time we talked about bit parallel exact search. Now we are going to show how we can do it as approximate search. Interestingly enough, in the journal where the exact search using bit parallelism was published in 1992, in the same issue, there was a proposal for bit parallel approximate search by other authors. So it was somebody has heard that people were working on something and they competed about this. Interesting. So, of course, you can find both original papers in our doc section. So if you are interested, you can read that. It's very interesting. As we said last time, originally this bit parallel exact search algorithm was called Shift-Add, not Shift-End. Now let's explain the dynamic programming approach. It's very easy to understand. That's why we are going to explain it first. So what we do is maintaining a matrix of so-called partial edit distances. A partial edit distance is distance between a prefix of one string to the prefix of another string. Prefix means the first n characters. Yeah? So we have considered suffixes, so prefixes the other way around. Now the cell with coordinates I and j in this matrix contains the edit distance between the prefix of the string x of length I and the prefix of the string y of length j. How do we compute the value in this cell? We do it on the basis of the previously computed values in other cells, which is a very good idea. This makes the computation efficient, more efficient than pure guess of the best transform. To this end, this formula has been developed. So, if the last character of those two prefixes of length I and of length j are the same, that's a match. A match doesn't cost anything. Then the value in the cell is equal, in the new cell, is equal to the value of the old cell. This is diagonal shift, you will see. So from the position with coordinates I minus 1, j minus 1, you get to the coordinates I, j, directly without any cost if the character in the end of the prefix of length I of the string x is equal to the length, to the character in the end of the prefix of length j of the string y. That's called a match. Now, if not match, then we have three possibilities. Either a substitution, that's a diagonal shift, you see, or a deletion or an insertion. All those cost one. That's why we have one plus. Minimum of these plus one, it will give the minimum. Now, you will see everything on an example. It's very easy to understand. So this is our matrix. Suppose we have two strings. One is annual and the other is annealing. This is an example from a book, one of the many books on this. And you see, the edit distance between these two is 4. How do I know that? You find it here. So when you fill the whole matrix, in the end, you find the edit distance. Which means the time complexity of this computation is I times j. Because this is the number of possible coordinates of this matrix. Number of elements. You have to find them all. to get this number. So we say that the time complexity of this computation of any distance is quadratic in the length of these strings. Now, as an example of application of this formula, consider this cell. So we want to compute this value. Okay? How do we do that? There are three values that determine this value. This one, that's a substitution. This one, that's a deletion. So that's, let's see, if this is I coordinate and this is j coordinate, then this is d of I j minus 1. That's this one. You see? That's a deletion. Okay? And then the horizontal move, that's a substitution. So you can get a longer string from a shorter one either by substitution or by deletion or by insertion. So, how did I get these two from these three values? First of all, each cell, its value is determined by where we have stopped in these prefixes. So, this was would this one that we are that we want to compute corresponds to transforming a ni ending with an a to nu ending with a u, or the other way around, nu to an e, doesn't matter. So what matters here? The formula says if these characters, the last characters, are the same, that's surely diagonal move. Now, are they the same? No, of course. This is A and this is U. Okay? So it will not automatically be the diagonal move. It may be diagonal because the diagonal transform, the substitution may cost less than insertion or deletion, but we have to check that. So which one gives the minimum? Okay? So, what's the cost of the substitution? The cost of the substitution of A by U or U by A is 1. Okay? So, we would have 1 plus 1, that's 2. So, the diagonal that costed 1 before, now it costs 2 because we have a substitution by not the same character. So, that would be this, where are we? This transform. So, that would be the substitution, this operation, okay? Either U by A or A by U, it depends on how you put these strings, which one will be above, which one will be below, it doesn't matter. So, if you reverse the strings, then what was the deletion would be insertion, and the other way around, for example here. So, this is a deletion. If you say that nu is transformed to an e. But if you say that an e is transformed to nu, that would be an insertion. And here the other way around. So this vertical line, that would be a substitution, you see, in our setting. So we chose that nu is transformed to an e. So it costed 2, obviously these are short strings, so you know that you can transform, you can get this number 2 by matching 3 characters and then inserting 2. Okay, so that would cost 2, and then you add 1 more, so that would be 3. And finally, if you insert, that would cost, so this one would be obtained by matching 3 and substitution, that would cost 1, that's this one. And now you are adding an insertion. So total cost is 2. Okay? So what is the minimum? The minimum is either this or that. Doesn't matter. So we do not care by which operation we get into this, if it costs the same. So the cost here would be 1 plus 1, 2, here 1 plus 1, 2 as well. So anyway, and this will be 2 plus 1, 3, so it's out of question. So we take the minimum, you see. So the minimum of the previous values would be 1, and then we add this 1 because all the operation cost 1. So this is how we get every possible value in this matrix. Now, of course, we need initialization. The initialization is how to fill the first row and the first column. You see? Now, what would mean transforming annealing to nothing? You actually delete characters. If you delete one, that will cost one. If you delete the first two, that will cost two, etc., etc. It's easy to fill out the first row. The same with the first column. What would that cost to transform nothing to annual? So you insert one character, you insert two characters, three characters, all the insertions cost the same, so it will be just this, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and here 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., etc., until 9. So you first initialize the matrix to these values, and then the rest is just to use this formula, and you easily get this value in the end, which means the optimal transform costs 4 from annual to annealing or annealing to annual. Now, this is the added distance computation. Now, the question arises, how do we search by means of dynamic programming? Well, we use the same formula, but we initialize differently. We initialize the first row with all zeros. This means that we can start finding our annual anywhere in this string annealing. Of course, we are now talking about finding a shorter string in a bigger one, in a longer one. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. So we fill the first row with zeros, otherwise the operation is the same. So that's the only thing that matters. So we put all zeros here. And this is what we get for the same example. We are trying to find annual in annealing with the tolerance 2. So we allow up to 2 errors. Obviously, if you look at these strings, annual is not found in annealing at all. So if you use exact search, it will fail. Now, if we introduce tolerance of 2 errors, then once we fill out this matrix, we actually look in the last row. And wherever we find that the value is smaller than or equal to 2, that actually determines the occurrence. So acceptable occurrence with acceptable tolerance. For example, you see there are 3 values that satisfy this. So 2 is less than or equal to 2, 1 is less than or equal to 2, 2 is less than or equal to 2, which means we accept finding annual in annealing. That's 2 errors. Anneal, that's 1 error. And then annealee, that's 2 errors again. So this is tolerable because we set k equal to 2. If we set k equal to 1, then we just have 1 possibility. So it would be annual in anneal, that's 1 letter of difference. So that's approximate matching, approximate search. This is search because we fill the first row with zeros by means of dynamic programming. So that has been known for decades. Now, the new method, which is more efficient, it's faster. That's why it's interesting. It's the simulation of NFA, which is bit parallelism. This NFA is special. It is not just one row as we had before. So before we had a linear structure. If you remember last time, we talked about that. Now we have a two-dimensional structure. It's a matrix form. The state 00 has a loop, the same as there. It reflects the fact that the search pattern can be found at any position in the search string. That's exactly what we had before with exact search. Now, Horizontal transition means a match, which means we advance one character in the search pattern and one in the search string. Vertical transition means an insertion. We advance one character in the search string, but we do not advance in the search pattern. So we have inserted a character from the search string. And diagonal transition with a solid line means an ordinary or so-called effective substitution, where we advanced one character in the search pattern and in the search string. So it's not a match, it's a substitution. So the characters are not the same. And diagonal transition with a dashed line means a deletion. We advance one character in the search pattern, but we do not advance in the search string. We just ignore that character from the search string. So dashed lines represent, if you remember last time we said, epsilon transitions. Epsilon transitions are transitions without input. And here is, for the same example, annual and annealing and the same tolerance, how this machine would look like. You see, you would have a bit for each character. These double circled characters, they are final states. If you reach the final state, then you have found an occurrence of the search pattern in the search string. If it occurs in the first row, in the zeroth row, let's say, that's zero errors. If it occurs in the first row, then it's one error. If it occurs in the second row, well, in the third, it depends how you count, that's two errors. So the first row, if you find annual, you see, you will have transitions, A, N, N, U, A, L. If you find that in the search string, then you find annual without any errors. So that would be the same as the exact match. So if you delete these two rows, then you would have a machine for exact matching. Now, each time a new character appears, the transitions are possible either horizontal, if you can match A with A. So in this case, yes. But also, here you see, sigma means any character. And these dashed lines, you see, that's an epsilon transition. That's a deletion. You can do whatever. You can, because this is a parallel structure, parallel machine. Some copy of this machine will make a horizontal, for example, when an A arrives. It will make a horizontal transform. Some of them can make a diagonal transform with this solid line. So that's it depends how you define. So if you say A with A is only possible to horizontal, for horizontal transform, which would be logical because we said transform by of the character with the same character doesn't cost anything. Okay, so we can say the horizontal transitions are possible, but if you have a horizontal, then you cannot have a diagonal transition with a solid line, because that would mean that would cost one. That's not true. It costs nothing. Because A transforming to NA doesn't cost anything, or N to N, or whatever. So we can introduce that, but it is not compulsory. So some machines are tolerated to do just that. So one copy can do this, and one copy can do that, no matter whether A is equal to A, or if it were different character. Now, you can also delete a character. So you can say, this A has arrived, one copy of this machine says, I don't want to match this, I want to delete it. That's also possible. And finally, you can insert this character. So the machine can say, A has arrived, I'm just going to insert this character. So that would be AA and UAL in the future. Now, obviously, you can sooner or later with this machine get to this point, because that's one error. Annual to anneal would get you to this point. And then you have a match. Since this pattern is relatively short, it's shorter than 64 bits, this would be extremely fast. Would be much faster than dynamic programming. Because dynamic programming has quadratic time complexity, obviously, and here, since you use parallelism, you have linear time complexity if the search pattern is shorter than the length of your computer word. And why is that? Because all these operations, all these transitions are done in parallel for one row. One row means one computer word. So for here, you would have three computer words, and that would be this machine. There are two groups of matching algorithms, but that's after the break that we are going to have now. Okay, so this noise that you hear here will not be recorded. So I have checked that. It will not affect the quality of the recordings. Yeah, it's a bit annoying here in the classroom. Okay.
You said that you would want to be the member of our reference group. You didn't send me an email.
Yeah, I would do it now.
You know my mail.
What?
The old brick?
Yes, it's a brick.
So it's just annoying sound in this room, but as I said, it doesn't affect the recordings. It's a pity that we have this. Terrible business.
There is some kind of conflict between Blackboard and Common.
Okay, then we continue. There are two groups of approximate matching algorithms, of which we are only going to consider this row-based bit parallelism. There is also possibility of so-called diagonal-based bit parallelism, where the transitions are counted this way. So not horizontally, but only diagonally. So this row-based bit parallelism, it was actually first published, as we said, in the same issue of the journal where they published the exact search using bit parallelism. In the same issue, you find this one, row-based bit parallelism algorithm, which is unconstrained approximate search allowing up to k errors, something that we have just seen with this dynamic programming, but in a different way. The algorithm updates the metrics associated with the search pattern row by row after processing each character of the search string, exactly what we discussed last hour. That's a machine like this. Of course, it is a bit differently explained in that paper. So if you read that paper, it's a bit difficult to read. So the explanation of how it really works is actually this one. If a final state becomes active in any row, an occurrence is found, as we have just discussed. Now, how do we make these transitions? As usual, with search algorithms that exploit bit parallelism, we have the update formula. Now, if we had exact search, the update formula is relatively simple. But if you look at the update formula for example, BNDM algorithm or BNDMQ, it's not that easy. However, we don't consider that's beyond of the scope of this course. Now, of course, you don't have to memorize this, but you have to understand that each of these elements of the formula, it actually describes one transition. So if there is no error, which means if we were waiting in some state of the machine for a character, say A, and A has arrived, then it will be this normal horizontal transition. That will be the same as shift OR. If you remember last time we talked about shift OR, that's it. So if there were no errors, that would be shift OR. So the update formula would be shift by one and OR with the bit mask. Okay? Now, you may have a substitution. That's this one. And you may have a match, which is a substitution by the same character. You see? Now, if you have a match, then that would, in our update formula, be something like that. Shift by one or with a bit mask. And if it were a substitution, you see, that would be shift by one and or with complement of the bit mask. And why is that? Because if you have a match, then you don't have a substitution. Because that would be, a match is a substitution with the same character. If you have a substitution with the same character, it's not logical to have a substitution with the same character twice. So that would be a horizontal and diagonal transform. So you just do not allow that with this complement of the bit mask. Now, if you concentrate a bit, you will see that it really works. Then you have a vertical transition. You see, that's insertion. You have diagonal transition with epsilon, so without input, that's diagonal transition, that's a deletion. Now, you see, for each row, you have to update the status of the row. So this prime, that's the next state. And this without prime is the current state, you see. So the next state, the match contribution, is considered this way. So the previous state, shifted by one or with a bit mask, and that's it. And then you see, and that's the superposition, you see. So one element of this matrix can be made active either by horizontal transition or by a diagonal transition or by vertical transition. So there are three ways to get, actually four, if you have diagonal transition by this of this epsilon. So it can be, so this one or any one can be made active in four ways. So superposition. It doesn't mean that it will be. If you get zero for each of these, which means active, that means that there are in practice that will be four copies for. Four elements in the depth of this machine. You see? Otherwise, if it is three, then three copies. If it is two, two copies. If it is one, one copy. If it is none, this state can be made inactive. Okay? Then this copy of the machine would be dead. So it would not accept characters any longer. So you can, this is an extension of the machine that was just this row. So, but the principle of operation is the same. So you can imagine that the machine makes copies of itself each time a new character arrives. So for each row, you have to compute all that. You see, Ri. I goes from 1 to k. And initialization, you see, R0 is all ones, R1 is 1 0 rightmost, R2 is 2 zeros rightmost, and Rk is k zeros rightmost. We are going to exercise that. How it works, it's actually best seen on an example. Okay? Now we finalize this discussion by considering the attack scenario. How can we, where could we use this approximate search? Now, if I were an attacker, I would have to modify the old attack pattern, and I usually use a tool because there is a lot of possible modifications. And tools have some initial parameters that say don't, for example, change more than 5 characters, something like that. So it's possible. So these are possibilities. I cannot delete more than E characters in total. I cannot insert more than I characters in total. I cannot substitute more than S characters in total. That's one possibility. So you limit the number of deletions, insertions, and substitutions in advance. As we said, for an attack, the new variant of the same old attack, to be successful, it has to remain harmful. So the old one was harmful. Now the new one also has to be harmful. Now if you change too much, chances are that it will not be dangerous any longer. So I explained that on this example. If you change this bit, so instead of 0, 0, 2, 0, nothing will happen. The attack will still be harmful. But if you change a dot or a slash, then it will not work any longer. Okay? So one of the scenarios would be to limit the total number of each of these operations. Another scenario would be, okay, I'll limit the number of insertions and deletions taken together. It has been studied in the literature. So I allow as many substitutions as you like, but I don't allow more than so-called indels to be more than D. Or, this is typical, for example, in IDS, it's possible, but this is typical in cryptography, in cryptanalysis. It has nothing to do with this course, but it has been used there. So we cannot delete more than E characters at a time, or more than I characters at a time. What does it mean? It means this. So if I have string, I say at each time, I cannot delete more than 2 characters in a row. So not 2 in total, but 2 consecutive characters. So that's the idea, at a time. So that's a possible scenario as well in our setting, IDS setting. With such an attack scenario, we have a small number of changes or a limited number of changes in the original attack traffic. So the original attack was an attack. So we know that it was dangerous. And now we want a new attack, as an attacker that would still be dangerous but would not be detected by the old rule of the opponent. Opponent side, yes. Now, if I make these changes too big, traffic could become harmless. I delete 5 characters just at random, it will probably do nothing. So it has still to do harm. So it must be small changes. Now, the distribution of changes matters, as we have shown. It is not the same when we change a bit in this dot dot slash or a bit in these 3 bytes in the end. So if we change a bit in 3 bytes in the end, no problem. So the attack will still be an attack. But if we change a bit in dot dot, it will not work. So if we had unconstrained approximate search, it only cares about the number of changes, but not about the distribution. So it would fail on this dot dot. Consequence, we would have false positives. We would have false alarm on traffic that is not harmful, even though it's an attempt to make a harmful traffic out of the old harmful traffic. Now, to this end, how do we mitigate that? We can use what we call constrained approximate search, and then these constraints actually are something like this. They correspond to the scenario taken by the attacker. So it would be this scenario or this scenario with indels or this scenario with the total number of each of the edit operations. So that's some possibilities. How do we know which constraints? Well, we say a priori knowledge is always possible to have about our opponent. If we are the defensive side, you know, it's like any other military activity. We know something about our opponent in advance. So we know, for example, which tool the attacker uses to transform his traffic, which is quite possible to get to know. That's called threat intelligence. You see, this activity, collecting information about what attackers can do. That's called threat intelligence. So if we guess well what he or she would do, then it can reduce the false positive rate. The false positive rate is very important because it is very annoying to have too many false positives. Now, later in this course, you will see how annoying it is. So if we compute how many alarms one operator gets during the day. Now, how can we realize this in the search algorithm? It depends on the constraint type. So you can introduce various counters and additional bit masks. Well, counters would complicate the things, but additional bit masks, that's quite possible. So it would just complicate a bit more this already complicated formula that is complicated for a human. But for a computer, it's easy because everything is done in parallel for all the bits of the computer world. Or you can consider that there are small changes in the original traffic, then you will, with high probability, guess what the attacker would do, and that's small overhead compared to the complexity of computation of this update formula. And finally, you can assign counters to each cell of the NFA array. This is highly inefficient, but it will still be fast. Now, the reason why we are doing this and not, for example, dynamic programming is that this is still faster. It's linear time complexity compared to the quadratic time complexity of the dynamic programming. But all this is just research. It hasn't been applied too much in practice so far. What is done in practice is actually what we said in the beginning. It's making new signature for every variant of an old attack, which is highly inefficient. You will see when we install Snort, you will find like 10 or 15 rules for the same attack just with a small detail change. But these are just known variants of the old attack. It may always be more variants. That's very difficult to cover by a misuse-based IDS. So using approximate search is actually a perspective method for solving this. But as we said, it introduces even more false positives, and we have to handle that. And how do we handle that? We handle that by using constrained approximate search, where we define constraints using threat intelligence. So using some parallel or side channels to get information about what tool with what parameters the attacker is using to change his or her originally harmful traffic. Okay, let's have a 5-minute short break just to switch the presentation, and then we start with Snort. Okay? That's called acoustic terror. I'm going to report that. I reported that we didn't have the parallel slides displayed. They fixed that, but I didn't report the sound.
Okay.
So I thought that they solved both things at the same time. Okay. So I hope that by the next week it will be solved. So we switched the presentation. Very terrible. The next subtopic that we are starting today, it will occupy a couple of sessions. In this course, it's about Snort. Now, so far, we have considered some theory. Now, we are going to see how this theory is applied in practice. So, Snort is a most widespread, misuse-based open-source intrusion detection system. It's a typical representative of such a system realized in software. It's open source, it's network based. Why is it widely deployed and studied? Because this architecture is publicly available. Everybody can download and look at the source code. Then the signatures are regularly maintained. There are organizations that take care of this. The signatures are easy to read. We have seen already a couple of examples. They are similar to ordinary English text. They are written in text files, and because of that, they are human readable, and one can easily change them. The ideas behind SNORT, they are used in other intrusion detection systems. They may be implemented differently for better efficiency. For example, Suricata is very similar by concept, but it, up to last year, was the only one that used threats. So they used the parallelism that exists in today's computers. And SNORT didn't have that. However, SNORT now has that as well. It's a SNORT 3. We are going to talk about that as well. Signatures or rules can be encoded in a different way in other systems, like Zeek, that we are going to consider as well. It can work as a misuse-based system or signature-based system, even though it's not by concept designed to be a signature-based system. However, you can use it as a signature-based system, but its signatures are quite different. And it may be more efficient to read them and process them. However, they are not easily read because you have to, by humans, you have to know the pattern matching and all these things. So we'll talk about that maybe in 2 weeks. Now, to speed up signature processing in SNORT, they use a special data structure, so-called rule tree nodes, RTNs, and option tree nodes, OTNs. We are going to talk about that. They are constructed right after SNORT starts, before processing any packets. That's why SNORT has long initialization. It also has increased memory consumption, but it pays before, because after that it runs pretty fast. Now, there are two current versions of SNORT. So you can use SNORT 2, like 2.9 or something. That's the current version. It does not use threats. That's the old SNORT. Now, SNORT 1, of course, it's not used at all. It's like 25 years old. But this SNORT 2, it's still in use. And the SNORT 3 project, since July 2021, since last year, it uses threats. It's very similar now, extremely similar to Suricata. It also includes other improvements over SNORT 2. However, SNORT 2 is massively used in practice. SNORT 3 is like 3.0, so it's still a kind of experimental. Now, you can apply SNORT in three ways. Of course, the first two are not interesting for us. So a packet interceptor, you can use it as a sniffer, but you have much better tools for this. So this is more like TCP dump. Now, you can use Wireshark. Today, everybody uses that for intercepting packets. However, Wireshark may be slow. We have seen last time when we launched this SynFlood, it fails miserably, so it's too slow. Cannot capture all this traffic. Now you can use it as a packet logger, so whatever appears on your network interface card, you put it in a file. So like 20 years ago, that was interesting as an application. However, today, it's not at all. So, of course, we use it as an IDS, and we can also use it as an IPS. It's called SNORT Inline. So it can also block traffic if you configure it to use this blocking. Of course, in this packet intercepting mode, it displays on the console the contents of every packet traversing the communication line. It may be interesting, but only as a means of fast capture. In the packet loading mode, it locks the packets in memory if you have enough memory, like hard disk, instead of being displayed on the console. Okay? So that's not intrusion detection. What is intrusion detection is the third option, this option, where it inspects each packet or session. Session is more packets, okay? And decides whether it is normal or malicious. It can also block malicious traffic if you configure it to be IPS or SNORT inline. Now, how do we inspect packets? We compare the content of the packet or a session with the list of attack signatures that are contained in a special misuse database. Well, we consider that in a theoretical way in the first lecture. We said it's a misuse database. In the case of Snort, it's a collection of files. So you can open all these files. They are .rules files. You open that. That's an ordinary text file with these signatures. So they are grouped by application, like HTTP rules or something like that. You will see that in the exercise. If we find indicators of suspicious activities, which means find a match between some rule in these files and the traffic, then by Snort terminology, they say alerts. Well, we say alerts or alarms, it doesn't matter. Now, the newest versions of Snort are fast, relatively fast. They have improved implementation of the search algorithm in the detection module. They can monitor gigabit networks like home network of today, but they cannot monitor 300 gigabit backbone network as Zeek actually can. So Zeek is a very interesting system you will see next time. Well, when we finish with Snort, we do Zeek. It's X-Bro. They call it Bro. Now, Snort can run as an IPS. That's called Snort Active Response now. It was called Snort Inline. Now it's Snort Active Response. It's inline operation. You put Snort between the traffic and the internal network. And when you detect something in this traffic, you engage the firewall to block this traffic. So it has special instructions in the rules to handle suspicious traffic. Well, when you install Snort, it includes a number of rules that pretend to be general for all networks, which is a very bad idea because not any network is general. Because of that, we get a bunch of false positives, which is terrible business. So we have to adjust our system after the installation. We are going to dedicate some time to how do we do that. Typical cause of these false positives are that the initial installation includes rules that detect attacks against something that we don't have in our network. Like if we are using Linux and it's a Windows attack, so why getting an alarm on this? Or if you don't run a web server and the attack is against a web server, it will not do any harm, but you get an alarm. How can we reduce the number of false positives? We have to modify the original rule setting sometimes. We can carry out that by adjusting some of the original rules to the specific network environment conditions. We can add new rules. We can delete some rules. We can ignore some traffic by making what is called a pass rule. So usually you have alarm on match. With the pass rule, you have no alarm on match. This adjusting or adjustment, it requires substantial effort after the installation. There are actually two things that we have to do. First of all, we have to eliminate, if possible, false negatives. So packet drop, that's a terrible business. So if our traffic is too fast, then we must distribute our computational power to several sensors to handle the traffic in such a way that we do not have these drops. Now we are going to show how we do that with one sensor, eliminate false negatives. However, it may not be possible completely. Then we have to distribute the traffic. So we have to reduce the load on one sensor. Once we do that, then we try to reduce the number of false positives. False positives are bad because they annoy the operator, so sooner or later the operator may ignore real alarms. The components of Snort follow a typical IDS scheme. We capture the packets externally through the library libpcap. It's a collection of system calls, we can say system calls, but calls to the sub-programs or subroutines that capture this traffic. So that's the interface to the network interface card. The advantage of this, that's the default method for many of these systems. The advantage is platform independence. The disadvantage is that it is slow. It can process one packet at a time. It's not suitable for high-speed networks. So other possibilities are contained in this library duck that is first installed before Snort. It's required now. It has actually several methods, but still libpcap is the default method. So it's platform independent. Other interfaces aside from this one, pcap, is that's the list. AF packet, it's similar to pcap, but better performance. This NFQ IPQ for the intrusion prevention variant. Then for BSD, that's a kind of Unix, you know that. Berkeley system Unix. It's this method, IPFW. And for testing various inline features, you can have this method, so-called dump raw traffic. Now, most often it's pcap still. So if we install that on one single host, as we are going to do in our exercises, it will be still this one. The block diagram of Snort, you can consider these two blocks as one. Then we have the data pre-processing stage, then we have the detection module, and then we have logging and alerting, where we also put some filters of alarms. That's also possible. So that would be a typical scheme of an IDS, if you remember our first lecture. Now, in this data pre-processing phase, we have packet decoder and the preprocessor. Preprocessors is something that is typical for Snort. So why do we need these preprocessors? We have already announced that in our previous lectures. It's very easy to fool an IDS without these preprocessors because, as we said, you change one bit of your attack traffic and then it will not be detected. So these preprocessors' role is to increase the flexibility of the system in such a way that it becomes capable of detecting some variants of attacks, or instead of using rules, it detects some attacks by using these preprocessors. That's sometimes more efficient than using rules. And this packet decoder, actually, that's just adjustment of formats. So it processes the raw packets collected externally. It extracts specific protocol elements for each packet that are needed for intrusion detection. It starts with the data link layer protocols like Ethernet, if it is a wire connection, then continues with network layer protocol, which is IP, finalizes with transport layer protocols, TCP and UDP. The result of packet decoding is a specific data structure. You will see the same thing you have in Suricata. It's just called differently, but it does the same. So this specific data structure contains elements of the protocols relevant for intrusion detection. It's not now raw data. It has now identified the elements of the protocol, and then these elements of the protocol are actually compared through this database of rules. The preprocessors prepare the packet data in order for the detection module to interpret them correctly. So it can prepare format, like this normalization of or defragmentation, and we mentioned this canonicalization, where you convert Unicode to UTF, etc., etc. So that's called canonicalization. But not only that. Some preprocessors detect some attacks by themselves. As we said, sometimes it's better to use these preprocessors than the rules. And, for example, port scanning is detected this way. So we have a preprocessor called SF port scan. That's typical. We are going to demonstrate that in our exercise. Now, SSH or DNS or ARP spoof, these attacks can be detected by preprocessors, not by the rules. And then there is another group of these preprocessors that do not do anything regarding intrusion detection. They monitor efficiency of how IDS does it, this intrusion detection, and gives detailed information about their use of resources. And then you can optimize its efficiency by varying the parameters. So that's the third group of these preprocessors. As we said, normalization, it's resolving for small changes in attack signatures that could make the corresponding attacks invisible by the detection model's exact string matching algorithm, like this, image / BMP for Unix and image / BMP for Windows. So if you have a rule for image / BMP, it will fail on image / BMP. That's a typical example, and we had another one in our first lecture about this canonicalization conversion of Unicode to UTF. That's the same thing. So we need normalization for this. Now, defragmentation and canonicalization, well, we said this. Unicode characters in URIs, this percentage, etc., etc., this is converted to ordinary characters in UTF. So that was the preprocessors. We are going into details a bit later. Now, detection module is the, of course, that's the heart of any misuse detection system, and SNORT in particular, matches packets against the rules located in the rule files. If we find a match, then we have an alert. Otherwise, we just move it out from the SNORT memory and go to the next packet or a session. The matching is exact. Now we know why it is important to be not just one rule for one attack, because there may be variants. So without preprocessor, that would be easy to fool the IDS to evade it, because you change one bit and that will fail. So for this, we have preprocessors in SNORT that are a bit more clever than the rules. Now, the logging and alerting subsystem forwards alerts to the operator, logs the relevant traffic and alerts if necessary. And how do we do this? There are many ways. So SNORT is flexible about this. Now, if you do all that by SNORT, then it will slow down the operation of SNORT. Because of that, it has been outsourced to another application that we are going to discuss later. In such a way, most resources of SNORT are dedicated to detection, because it has to be capable of handling high-speed traffic, like gigabit. When SNORT was invented, most networks were 10 megabits per second. So that was in 1998-9. Now it's 2022, so we have much faster networks. So let's go into details. The data pre-processing stage of SNORT consists of the packet decoding block, that's purely technical, and the preprocessor block, that's more advanced. So the packet decoder, well, all the definitions of protocols, they are contained in what you already know, this request for comment. So these RFCs, they describe these protocols. Now, RFC is not a standard. It's request for comments, which means implementation may vary. That's between the operating systems, and that's a source of trouble for IDS as well, because the attackers can manipulate that. How each operating system interprets RFC, it is known. For example, Unix may interpret this differently from Windows, etc., etc. So this has happened, and it has been exploited in the past. And because of that, we are going to discuss what is called target-based reassembly, as we are going to see, where target is the target operating system. So these values of different protocol fields, for example, say IP, it is known, if you open our presentation that we didn't discuss in the class, but I told you to just to recall the information that you know from other courses about the structure of the headers of all these protocols. It is contained in that presentation and in many books and online everywhere. So these values have to be extracted and they have to be stored in a special data structure that is further used by the rest of Snort. Each protocol supported by Snort has its corresponding record that contains the values of the protocol fields. Now, we have root protocols and chain protocols. These chain protocols are invoked from the root protocols. Okay? So the root protocols are analyzed first. So that's the wire. Ethernet point-to-point protocol, that was interesting when we used modems. If you remember that, maybe you were not born at that time, but that was in 1995, 6, something like that. So that's this protocol. Okay? Then point-to-point protocol over Ethernet, that's also possible. Null for decoding on loop dead devices and all. Of course, this Ethernet is most often used. Then we have chain decoders. They are invoked from the root decoders. ARP, Ethernet loopback, this is a virtual one, it's not a wireless one. IP, IPv6, of course, this is most often, and then the protocol that is called from IP, it's TCP or UDP or ICMP or whatever. And that will be something like that. So you first have root decoders, that's from the packet interceptor, raw traffic. So it has been intercepted by network interface card by means of this libpcap. It was extracted as raw data. And then from that, we first look at what was the wire. So we say it was Ethernet, and then from Ethernet, we say, well, is it IP? It is IP, or it is, it may be IPv6. And then from IP, say, okay, it's TCP. So each of these is called from the previous one. And if you remember the exercise that we had last time, if you look at Wireshark, the protocol of the next layer is contained in the previous layer as data section. Okay? So that's how the system knows that it is TCP the next one. Or it is UDP, because it is set somewhere. And then it is considered as data, and then you analyze just the data with the protocol for the decoder for the next protocol in the chain. And then once you extract the necessary information, then you forward it to the preprocessors. Example, the chain decoder for the IP protocol is invoked from the root decoder for the Ethernet protocol. That's typical. And then depending on the value of the protocol field in the IP header, if you looked at our materials that we provided in Blackboard, you will see the header of IP. And there is a field that says what protocol is in the data section. That's what I have just said previously. So the next chain decoder that will be invoked from within the IP decoder will be either UDP or TCP or ICMP, depending on what this protocol field in the IP header says. So that was about these packet decoders. That's purely technical. It doesn't depend on Snort or whatever, because you can do it in many ways. There are so many pieces of software that do the same thing. You take raw traffic and then you extract the protocol fields for every protocol in the chain. Now, the preprocessors are something very Snort specific. So, since the detection module cannot handle all the variations of input traffic efficiently, the idea of the creators of Snort was to use some kind of preprocessors, not the rules, to handle all that. This improves flexibility and efficiency of the overall IDS because of their modular nature of these preprocessors. You can switch them on and off. Some preprocessors depend on the others, so you have to take care of that. But in theory, you could switch off some preprocessor. That increases the efficiency. Most preprocessors perform data format adjustments to mitigate IDS evasion techniques. That's the main reason why they exist, prior to sending packets information to the detection module. That's one possibility. Another possibility is for some attacks, it's better to use preprocessors to detect them than the rules. Typical example is port scan, because there are so many variations of how ports can be scanned that it is better to use a special preprocessor for that than 10,000 rules. Okay? Then you have special preprocessors. Some of them monitor system performance. Some of them detect whether traffic is in cipher, since Snort is not capable of analyzing in cipher traffic. Some protocols take out the what is called PII, personal identifiable information, from traffic. So they anonymize data. So there are such. Well, we are not very interested in them. We just mentioned them. But regarding monitoring of system performance, that's interesting, because for software-based misuse detection systems, speed is crucial. Okay, let's have a break. The noise terror continues. So, as I said, I'm going to report that we have these noise problems, but it doesn't affect the
don't know whether you have seen this on Piazza. Somebody asked me about these big virtual machines, how we could mitigate buying a new machine just for one exercise. So you may try to use dynamic disk.
Okay.
So when you create a virtual machine, this will make the machine slower. But it may be enough for our exercises. So, yeah, you try that. Why do we need 40 gigabytes? Because, well, the experience says if you install Snort, Zeek, and Suricata at the same time, and two variants of Snort, Snort 2 and Snort 3, 20 gigabytes is not enough. So we increase. But maybe we do not have to increase the size of router. Can be still 20 gigabytes. So we can save some space. You can try dynamic.
Okay.
Now, we are continuing with the preprocessors of Snort. Well, 25 years ago, when the creators of Snort made the preprocessors, they did not think about what we shall call, when we talk about machine learning, feature selection. But implicitly, they, in these attack-detecting preprocessors, the very existence of them, the idea of using them, indicates that the relevance of some traffic features was considered implicitly at the design time. So it's a kind of machine learning. Now, since the preprocessors can be used for these purposes, we can divide the preprocessors into three functional groups. The first one are called data normalization preprocessors that primarily perform technical format adjustments. Then this part is not so interesting. This may be sometimes useful in prevention of IDS evasion attacks. However, some of those also include functionality that detect attacks. And why is that? Because many attacks actually manipulate the protocol, like fragmentation on IP. So this has been exploited in many attacks. So this can be detected by the preprocessors. The next group is attack detecting preprocessors that are designed just to detect some attacks. So they perform intrusion detection by themselves. You will see some of them, some of examples you will see. And these special preprocessors more or less monitoring performance, etc., etc. Regardless of the functional group where a preprocessor belongs, its functionality may depend on the functionality of other preprocessors, usually these two basic preprocessors, FRAG and STRING. FRAG is for IP and STRING is for TCP and UDP. Okay, let's discuss data normalization preprocessors. Well, as we know, new attacks appear very often and methods of IDS evasion constantly evolve. Because of that, there is a possibility that SNORT either does not detect such attacks or does not detect them efficiently. Because of that, data normalization preprocessors have been included in the SNORT architecture since 2000, something like that, the year 2000. They normalize data. The detection module can interpret them properly. As we said, this is less important. What is more important is that they detect anomalies in protocol implementation, and these were sources of attacks. So anomalies in implementation of protocol, since the protocol is, the description of the protocol is RFC, it's not ISO standard or something that everybody has to implement in the same way. So this was the source of trouble because it was exploited in attacks. Now, what are these preprocessors? This one is extremely important, this FRAG, fragmentation. Huh? Session, stream, RPC decode, HTTP inspect, this did not exist until recently. And the advantage of Suricata was that since the very beginning of its development, it included HTTP inspection protocol, some kind of that. Analysis engine for HTTP. So SNORT didn't have that. It analyzed HTTP packet by packet, but not the whole session. That was the problem. Now, of course, it includes that, the newest versions. Then you have SMTP, POP, IMAP, FTP, etc., etc., so you don't have to memorize all that. But what you have to know is this FRAG. Because on FRAG, many other preprocessors depend. So FRAG is the IP defragmentation module, which also handles some IP implementation subtleties on different operating systems. It detects some anomalies in IP fragmentation as well, which is important for detection of attacks. The current version is FRAG 3, and the current version has been for years. So FRAG 3. Now, how it is implemented? Well, doesn't matter too much, just to mention that it is implemented by means of hash table and linked lists, and it's because of that faster than the previous version, FRAG 2, that has been stopped like 15 years ago, maybe even before that. So FRAG 2 is not actual at all, but FRAG 3 is the one that is still used. Now, we said that there are subtleties in implementation of protocols. The policy that is followed in SNORT is, regarding that, is the target-based fragmentation reassembly. Okay? You see, the fragments of traffic are coming different ways, so they have to be reassembled at the destination. You know how the IP works. Okay? Now, how this is done depends, unfortunately, on the operating system, because not all the operating systems interpret the RFC for IP in the same way. That's why in the intrusion detection, they have to be aware of the operating system on which, that is the destination of the traffic. Okay? So the fragmentation reassembly process is aware of the operating systems that run on the host in the monitor network. So if the traffic is directed towards a BSD machine, for example, then the IP has to be interpreted as BSD interprets that. So this defragmentation. The preprocessor reassembles the fragments in the same way as the operating system. That's important because this can be manipulated and it can be a source of attacks. So the attacks that exploit the fact that different operating systems assemble the fragmented packets in different way is prevented in this way. Because you reassemble traffic the same way as the destination operating system does. That's more or less the reason for using this policy. The next important data normalization preprocessor is stream. So what FRAG is for IP, stream is for TCP and UDP. So it's TCP reassembly module, which is capable of tracking TCP sessions and UDP traffic. We cannot say UDP sessions because there are no sessions in UDP. In UDP, there is no establishment of session. Okay? Like in TCP. In TCP, you have first to establish the connection, and then the session is until the end of that connection. But in UDP, the session, what they call session, is a sequence of consecutive packets that are from the same host to the same destination. TCP is also reassembled according to the reassembly policy on that destination operating system. So that's also target-based reassembly. So TCP reassembly is performed according to the way the host in the monitor network to which the packets are directed does it. If it is some Linux, it is done the same way as that Linux distribution does. As we said, UDP traffic, there are no sessions in UDP, but they call it sessions, which is a series of UDP packets from two hosts through the same ports. Stream also monitors ICMP messages in order to detect destination unreachable and service unavailable, which can indicate that it is a port scan or something like that. It also handles implementation subtleties of different operating systems. It detects various protocol anomalies that could be exploited in attacks. So why is it important to detect these subtleties? Because they have been used in attacks. And it's difficult to describe that by means of a rule. It's better to use a dedicated preprocessor. So these two, the FRAG and the stream, they are most important preprocessors. So you should know that. The next important one is HTTP inspect, because most traffic today is HTTP. Simply because of that, it decodes the data buffer, it finds the HTTP fields, it normalizes these fields, and integrates with stream preprocessor to handle sessions, not only packet-by-packet processing, which was the case before. So Snort was notorious for not having HTTP analysis engine. Now it has that. The primary role of this preprocessor is to normalize traffic directed to web servers. There are also anomalies in HTTP protocol implementation because HTTP is also RFC. The description. Alerts are produced upon detection of such anomalies in the HTTP protocol implementation. Now we are going to list some other preprocessors. that are not often used, but normalizer is used, for example, in IPS mode. It helps in preventing successful application of IPS evasion techniques. It can alert on drop, or it can drop packets with suspicious encoding, and it normalizes IPv4, IPv6, ICMP, and TCP. So these were the data normalization preprocessors, of which we listed the most important ones. So it was FRAG, Stream, HTTP Inspect, and Normalizer. Normalizer is important for intrusion prevention. Then we have the preprocessors that were designed just to detect some specific, very specific, you will see some old-fashioned ones, old-fashioned attacks. The primary role is to detect attacks by themselves. It is usually not possible to define signatures for that, or it's very difficult, and because of that, it's better to have dedicated preprocessors. And the typical example is port scanning. We would have to have thousands of rules for each variant of port scan, so that's very difficult. Such examples of these preprocessors are SF port scan, that's for detection of port scans, SSH, DNS, ARP, spoof, SIP, etc. SIP has become important recently because of telephony that is now IP based, so this traffic has increased enormously. Regarding this SF port scan, we are going to see that in practice in our exercise. It detects ordinary port scans generated by the tools, for example, nmap, we have already seen that. The main assumption, how do we detect? Now, just a small digression. In this course, what is important is not to explain how some system is used. It's important to explain how some systems work, because you are engineers and you have to understand not only it's like driving a car. So everybody can learn to drive a car, but not everybody knows how the car works. So it's the same thing. So how can we detect port scans? In normal communication, if you send ping somewhere or a TCP request or something, a negative response from a host, it's not usual as a result of closed ports. So it's highly unlikely that you want to access the port 10,031, for example. Now, if somebody, this is normally closed. What is normally open is like port 80 if you run a web server. So if you try TCP to port 80, chances are that you get the response. But if you try TCP request to 137, that's rare, it's strange. Now, if you get negative response, that's probably indication of a kind of port scan, especially if you do it many times to different ports in a very short time period. So that's the idea of port scan detection by means of these preprocessors. So SF port scan actually detects and keeps track of such negative responses. So that's the idea. Categories of port scan depending on the number of hosts that perform or receive scans. It can be one-to-one, that's easy to imagine. It can be distributed scans. Many sources, they scan one target. That's possible. Or one source scans many targets. These are called port sweeps of or horizontal scans. This may be interesting, because such a thing may mean that somebody has discovered a vulnerability, and this attacker is looking for a potential target that has some port open that should not be open, where this vulnerability resides, and wants to exploit that. So this one will be extremely dangerous, such a scan, so this port sweep. But even one-to-one scan can be dangerous, because if you are a target, very valuable target, like a bank or something, so you have, and the attacker has some internal information that something could be wrong on some section, then he or she could even try this. This one-to-many is very often done by these script kiddies, so-called. So they just browse through the whole internet to find vulnerable machines. Now, there are some so-called decoy versions of port scans, and these are port scans with spoofed source addresses combined with real destination addresses. This is something that we have tried in our exercise. We spoof the address, and then the response is directed somewhere else. Okay, you can even spoof address in such a way that this address is not active, and then the response goes somewhere. You are not interested in that, but by this you can actually determine whether the port is open, and the target cannot detect where the traffic is coming from. Because you can imagine that you launch the port scan from some spoofed address, like 19.4.1.3.1.31.1. I just guessed some address. Now this machine is down. But you have this address. Okay? And you send scan traffic not from this address, but with this spoofed address to some target. Something like that, sorry, 8888. So the traffic is, this machine thinks that the traffic is coming from here. Now this guy, he monitors the network, and the response will be detected from this machine. So the traffic from this address will go to this address, and this guy, he will detect this, and he can say this port is open. And this guy will not know that this guy was launching this traffic. So that's decoy port scan. Extremely dangerous, and this is actually not easily detectable. Now, SF port scan can do that. Detect such a thing. Now, one-to-one scan, it's a traditional scan performed by a single host and directed to a single host, okay? So SF port scan detects TCP, UDP, IP scans of this kind. Many-to-one, many hosts query a single host for open ports in order to evade IDS, obfuscate command and control hosts, etc., etc. And SF port scan detects TCP, UDP, and IP distributed scans through the target host. Okay, and one too many, we have actually discussed that. One host scans a single port on multiple hosts, typically used when we have a zero-day attack, well, want to launch a zero-day attack, and we are looking for potential victims. Now, SF port scan, how can it detect such a port scan? It can, provided that the port in question is normally closed. So if you use a zero-day attack on port 80, it will not be possible to detect by any means because port 80 is very often open. Now we have something that is called filtered port scans. Sometimes the negative responses, such as destination unreachable or reset, they are actually not sent. So the provider of traffic of internet operator, they filter out these port scans, these responses, just to prevent detection of port scan, of open ports by the scanner. The target simply drops the incoming port scanning packets, and SF port scan detects such situations, generates alerts on such scans if necessary, if it is configured to do it like that. It can be IP, TCP, UDP, ICMP, filtered port scans, distributed port scans, and port switch, so anything like that. So that was a typical example of an attack detecting preprocessor that works more efficiently for port scans than writing rules. The next one is SSH, for example. It detects several exploits or vulnerabilities of the SSH service. These are, well, this is extremely old. This is like 20 years old. Challenge response buffer overflow, CRC32, secure CRT, and protocol mismatch exploit. So these are four exploits for which an SSH preprocessor was actually designed to detect these attacks instead of rules. So these first two, challenge response buffer overflow and CRC32, these two attacks, they occur after the key exchanged with SSH. You know SSH is for encrypted traffic. You first have to exchange the keys to establish secure connection with the remote machine. So these two, challenge response buffer overflow and CRC32, they occur after the key exchange. So because of that, the corresponding traffic is enciphered and cannot be detected by a snort rule. That's why we need a preprocessor. Because once the connection is established, the traffic continues encrypted. And the encrypted traffic, logically, you cannot search for anything. So the SSH preprocessor detects such attacks by counting the number of bytes sent to the server. And why can we do that? Because we know that it's this attack. So this attack has the property that the number of these bits is huge after the key establishment. So in both attacks, more than 20 kilobytes of data are sent to the server immediately after the authentication challenge. So that's something that helps detection. So sending 20 kilobytes immediately after this is suspicious. An alert is generated if the byte count exceeds a limit defined in advance in a predefined number of packets. So you have this preprocessor, and this preprocessor has some parameter. You read in the manual what is the name of this parameter and how many bytes are set by default. You can change that. The SSH version string is used to distinguish between the challenge response buffer overflow and the CRC32, because one is for SSH version 2, that's this challenge response buffer overflow, and the CRC32 is for SSH version 1. And this is open, this is not encrypted, because you have to know which protocol to use to establish the connection. Now, this other two attacks, the secure CRT attack and the protocol mismatch attack, can be detected before the key exchange with SSH. So this traffic is not encrypted. So these have their own subtleties, and this is done, detection is done through this preprocessor. It's more efficient than to use a rule. So these were representatives of attack detecting preprocessors. You see, there are many more, but these are typical. Now we have special preprocessors that do not detect attacks or do not perform format adjustments. Instead, they provide capabilities of blacklisting and whitelisting. That's one possibility. They can monitor performance of the system. This is very important, so you can activate this preprocessor. It's not activated by default, but if you are concerned about how efficient your system is running, how efficiently your system is running, then you can activate this one and look what happens. This is typically done immediately after the installation, because what you want is to reduce the number of false negatives and false positives. You can also try to detect if the traffic is enciphered, because then you can drop that traffic. You cannot analyze that traffic. Only the headers. You cannot analyze the content. You can identify this personal identifiable information, for example, of the monitor client, because by the law you are not allowed to manipulate or to even to see this data. Sometimes these special preprocessors decode special mobile telephony and SCADA protocols, like this GTP and Modbus. So, after this decoding, you can write rules for detection of intrusions in such networks as if they were TCP/IP networks. Now, examples of these special preprocessors are reputation, performance monitor, SSL TLS, sensitive data preprocessor, GTP, Modbus, and DMP3. These are SCADA protocols. Now, reputation preprocessor provides basic IP blacklisting and whitelisting capabilities. So it's like a firewall. It can drop, it can block, they can pass traffic from a list of IP addresses. So you can use it instead of a firewall. It runs before other preprocessors and solves the efficiency problems of implementation of reputation-based IP blocking by means of standard rules, because processing of rules takes time and memory. So in the earlier versions of Snort, that was the problem. So that's why they wanted to introduce a reputation preprocessor to increase the efficiency. The IP list to block or drop or pass, they are loaded from external files, and you can have just any number of these white lists and black lists. That was just a couple of words about this preprocessor. Now, performance monitor deserves more attention. So it measures the real time and the theoretical maximum performance of Snort. What you get from it is the timestamp, the packet drop rate, the data rate on the wire, the number of alerts per second, and many other things. It can report events. You see, the ratio non-qualified events compared to the qualified events. Now, what is non-qualified event? It's the rule that was evaluated and did not match, which means you wasted resources for that. So whenever you do not match, then you have used the resources for nothing because the alert is not produced. And the number of qualified events is the number of rules that were evaluated and matched. So you count the number of times where you evaluated the rules that did not match and the number of times that you had the rules that matched, and this ratio should not be too high. Too high ratio means that you use your resources inefficiently. In order for a misuse-based IDS to be efficient, the non-qualified events to qualified events should be as small as possible. Ideally, it would be each time you have evaluation of a rule that will match. Now, you can achieve that easily by attacking very, very often. But that's crazy. It doesn't happen in practice. So it's very difficult to get this ratio equal to 1, but it should not be like 10,000. So if it is not the case, the system has to be additionally tuned. Sometimes you evaluate some, typically, you match, you have imprecise rules. They match too often for the things that should not match. So we'll discuss that later. Now, SSL TLS detects whether incoming traffic is in cipher. If so, well, we cannot analyze it. How do we do that? Well, it's a stupid way. You just monitor the port 443, but I can easily fool the system by launching traffic to that port that is not in cipher. So we shall discuss that a bit later when we talk about Zeek and Suricata. So originally the traffic was detected by ports to which the traffic was sent. However, nobody forbids you to send traffic that is not intended, for example, for web server to the port 80. You can send whatever to any port. And then in such a way you can fool the IDS. Now, suppose that in cipher traffic is sent to 443 as it should, then we consider such a session enciphered or encrypted, and we just ignore that traffic. Now, we have to be sure. That's why we wait for establishment of encrypted connection. So we look at both sides of the communication. Otherwise, just request is not enough, because the other side can say, I'm not encrypted. And then you don't analyze traffic that you should actually analyze. Then we have this sensitive data preprocessor that detects and filters personal identifiable information, PII, which should not be processed by the detection module or recorded in the system. That's by law. For example, in Norway, it's strictly forbidden. You cannot do that. Now, PII includes credit card numbers, in US, social security numbers, email addresses, so you cannot do that. You cannot record without permission. And in Europe now, with this new policy since 2018, you have this, I forgot, GDPR, yeah, that's the one. So you cannot do that. PII can be customized. That may include other information, not just this. Now, this is also important. GTP decoding preprocessor, GPRS tunneling protocol is used in mobile telephony, for example. It's not SCADA, it's for mobile telephony. So you have IP. In mobile telephony, you don't use TCP after IP. You use UDP. And why is that? Because the error correction is done by error correcting codes. So you don't need TCP. TCP is stupid in the sense that if an error occurs, the whole traffic is, the establishment is repeated. Well, that's very inefficient. Now, in mobile telephony, you cannot allow that. That would cause trouble in communication. So you actually use a special protocol, GTP, that decodes that it is tunneling. And then after that, all the traffic that is after this GTP protocol, that's actually if it were ordinary IP-TCP traffic. So you can analyze, you can use the rules for IP-TCP traffic even though you have mobile telephony traffic, something like that. That's why with this, we need this GTP, and for that we have this preprocessor that will convert traffic into this part in such a way you can use ordinary rules for this traffic. So this preprocessor decodes the protocol and extracts the encapsulated EP, TCP, and HTTP information. That's the only thing that is sent to the rest of the system. Now, the system doesn't know that whether it is from mobile telephony or from wire. It is the same for it. There are two subsystems, GTP decoder and GTP preprocessor. GTP decoder extracts the encapsulated IP, TCP, and HTTP data, and GTP preprocessor enables writing rules as if there were no GTP. So we use as if it were any other network. Because that's also transparent for the user. When you use internet on this mobile telephone, you don't care about IP, UDP before GTP. Now, SCADA also has its preprocessors, Modbus and DMP3. So Modbus is used in SCADA networks. It's preprocessor that corresponds to this one, decodes the protocol and extracts the protocol fields, and then you can also write the rules as if it were no SCADA system. Otherwise, you would have to write rules specific for Modbus. The same for DMP3. So these two protocols are very often used in SCADA systems. So that was about the preprocessors. The next one is the detection module, and we said already last time that the default search engine there is the Yahoo-Korosik algorithm. Now we are going to explain how it is implemented and used in SNORT, in a concrete system. So the purpose of any detection module in any misuse detection system is to perform search for attack signatures in the packets or sessions that is forwarded to it from the preprocessing module. If we identify an attack signature, then we raise an alarm. So that's the basic idea. We know that from before. Now, in Snort, the default algorithm for performing search is the AHA-CoRSIQ algorithm, but not implemented in a pedagogical way, as we discussed last time. It is implemented in a way that makes it run even faster, and that's time optimization, and also it optimizes the space usage as well. Now, the time optimization is, you can either use NFA or DFA. We mentioned that. So this delta function that we mentioned when we talked about AHA-CoRSIQ, we didn't explain how we get this delta function. We are going to do it now, because this is used in Snort. So if you remember, with NFA, there may be several next state transitions per input symbol. We counted up to 3 last time when we talked about AHA-CoRSIQ. Now we convert such a graph, go-to graph, into a special graph, which has a much more complicated structure, but it only has just 1 transition per input symbol, which means it runs faster. The cost is, of course, since it has more complicated structure, you need more memory to memorize the graph. Given an NFA, the corresponding DFA can always be constructed, and this is done in Snort if you configure it to, when you install Snort, to use DFA by default. The motivation for converting NFA to DFA is possible gain in efficiency, up to 50%. Now, that's in general search. In Snort, it's highly unlikely to get a very large gain with this. And why is that? Because Snort spends most of the time in the state 0, waiting for an input symbol that would move it to some other state. If you are heavily under attack, that's another story, but normally no. Then converting from NFA to DFA will not give you 50%, near, even not 10%. So in most cases it doesn't pay to use more memory and not to get much on speed. Still, DFA implementation is present in Snort. It may give certain gain if it is very important for you. It will be a bit faster at the cost of using much more memory. Why is it faster? Because we pre-compute all the possible next states for each state of the NFA. The failure function F and the go-to function G are used to construct the next move function delta that we mentioned last time, but we didn't explain it, and now we are going to do that. And the failure transitions are eliminated, so we don't have the failure function any longer. So, a deterministic finite automaton consists of a finite state of states S and the next move function delta, such that for each state S, small s from big S, this set, an input symbol alpha, delta of S alpha is always in S. So there is no fail. The DFA consequently makes exactly 1 state transition on each input symbol because this always exists. So this destination state. How can we convert NFA to DFA? We start from the go-to function and the failure function. The next move function delta is constructed by pre-computing the results of every sequence of possible failure transitions. The time complexity of the conversion algorithm is linear in the size of the set of search patterns, which is good. Of course, this algorithm, formally, you don't have to memorize. What we do is, well, I explain on an example how this is done. You will see that it is actually easy. Remember our example from last time, snort on snow. That was the search string. And the function g and f, they were obtained in the previous examples. Now we are going to refer to that. I may open the corresponding presentation just to show you. Snort on snow. So these were our patterns. Snow, snort, and all. This was the go-to function, the graph, and this was the failure function. Okay, so you had some failures where you don't go to zero, which means more than one transition at a time. Okay? Now, how can we obtain the delta function, a more complicated graph, out of this? Well, you take the set of symbols that are present in our set of patterns, all of them. So it was snort, snow, and or, if you remember. So N, O, R, S, T, and W. So these are only letters that exist there. Now, if you are at the current state 0 and an input symbol is O, okay, you look at this one. So you're here and O has run, you go to 7. So there is no other possibility. Okay, so you, in the delta function, it will be the same. Now, if S arrives, you go to 1. And that's it. If anything else arrives, since you have a loop, you stay at 0. That's easy. Now, 1. If N arrives and you are at 1, you go to 2. Okay, that's easy. So you put it here. Now, if O arrives and you are in 1, you're in 1. O has arrived, you see? What's that? That's a failure. It says, you are here, O arrives, you go to 0. And then you try to match O, you see? Concentrate, because that's a typical error that is done by the students. They put 0 here, but remember, you have to try to match O again. So you were at 1, and O has arrived, you see? So the failure function says, go to 0, but then try to match O from here, and you do. And you go to 7. So what you put here, if O arrives, you put 7, not 0. That's extremely wrong. That's a source of error for our students. They don't complete this task to the end. And then if S arrives and you are in 1, S arrives. You see? Failure again. You see? It says, the failure function, it says go to 0, try to match S. And you try to match S. You see? From 0, you remain at 1. You see? That's what happens. Now, any other, it's easily seen that then you go to 0 because you cannot match from 0. So the failure function from 1 is always go to 0, you see? Go to 0, but from 0, only if O or S arrive, you can go to some other state. If anything else arrives, you will stay at 0 because of the loop. Now, you can now imagine how this graph looks like. You see, if you are in the state 0 and input symbol O arrives, you go to 7. Okay? If S arrives, you go to 1. If anything else arrives, you remain at 0. So that was easy. But now you are at 1. And N arrives. Okay? It says go to 2. O arrives. It says go to 7. You see? And S arrives. It says stay at 1. You see? And anything else arrives. It says go to 0. So not O or S or N. You see? Now it's not three things. Okay? So already now you see how this graph can be complicated. And of course, by following the procedure, you can get the other. Now you see, for each of them, you will get several possibilities, so this graph will be very complicated. So that will be all for today. Next week we start from here, so we continue with our snort, and tomorrow we shall exercise the search techniques. So bye-bye.